as if losing her son, Crew, to a heart defect when he was 13 days old in 2016 wasn't bad enough, April Standring had to watch as her 2.5-year-old daughter, Maisie, was diagnosed with a high-risk form of leukemia just 4 months later, in February of 2017. April will talk about Maisie's journey, in which she was able to ring the bell, signifying that her pediatric leukemia treatment was over, and that her beloved daughter, now 9 years old, is living her best life possible, more than 7 years after her diagnosis. Thank you for listening to this podcast. April Standring was told even before his birth in the summer of 2016 that her soon-to-be newborn had a heart defect and would not live for very long. That analysis very unfortunately proved to be correct, as her son Crew was born on September 29th of that year and passed away on October 12th, not even surviving 2 full weeks. 4 months later, on February 6th of 2017, April noticed a bump on the head of her 2.5-year-old daughter, Maisie. And it is now my pleasure to introduce April to my audience and to welcome her to my podcast, as she will talk about her life and Maisie's life and how those have gone over the last 7 years, which thankfully has a much better outcome. Thank you very much for joining me. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, as we begin our podcast, we need to look back at some of the darkest days imaginable, which did begin in the summer of 2016, as you were told about Crew's heart defect and where that would lead. And then less than 4 months later, you noticed this bump on your daughter Maisie's head. What were your thoughts at the time? And initially, how concerned were you about this bump?
My thoughts at the time were, she probably just bumped her head, you know. I remember her, she had been wrestling with my husband and my other sons at the time. I had 2 boys older than her. And so when I found it, I called my husband and just said, "Hey, do you remember Maisie hitting her head yesterday?" Or he's like, "No, I don't, you know." And then my next thought was, how did I, you know, miss this? Like, how have I not noticed this bump? Because it was a pretty good size. But it was kind of hidden on her scalp above her right ear. So it was up here and it was probably the size of like a ping pong ball. And so I just thought, how did I not notice this before, you know?
Certainly understandable. And I have to tell you that before our podcast, for some reason, I thought that Maisie might be your only child, and I find out you've got 6 children. So the fact is, you're so busy trying to take care of everybody that it's okay if you miss something, particularly if it's hidden. So for the next 2 weeks, you took Maisie to a number of doctors' appointments, and she received a misdiagnosis of fibrous dysplasia, which is a benign bone condition. Following that, you met with both a neurosurgeon and a craniofacial surgeon who told you that her bump was not presenting as if it was cancerous, but they ordered a biopsy anyway. Had you been concerned or had the thought crossed your mind that maybe cancer was in play here, especially after you had just lost a son, not through cancer, but still through a very unfortunate health situation? Did cancer cross your mind?
No, not really. I thought, you know, I went through my hard thing and now I'm done. Like, this will just be a simple fix. And they first ordered the CT scan that day, which I'm grateful for. And they said that, I'll never forget, we were sitting in the the room waiting for the doctors to come back in after the CT scan, and the scan came up on the screen. And I'm not sure why, but it just was on the computer screen in there. And my husband's a dentist, so he reads x-rays, but for teeth, right? And so he looked at it and said, "That doesn't look like a bone." And I kind of thought, yeah, you don't know. You're not a doctor, you know? I kind of dismissed him. And then the neurosurgeon came in and said the same words. That's not a bone that's growing there. It's not fibrous dysplasia, but we don't know what it is. It could be, he said, it's not really presenting like a typical cancerous lump, and it's not, because it's outside of the brain, so it's not a brain tumor. And it doesn't look like an infection because it wasn't red, it wasn't tender, like a typical infection would present. So from there, that's when they decided to order the biopsy, which was a couple days later.
Before they actually did the biopsy, were you at least comforted by the thought that it was not presenting as cancer? Did that kind of stick in your mind, and was that what you were holding on to?
I think my nerves kind of started to, up to that point, I had been completely at ease about it because we had that benign diagnosis. And I had noticed another lump forming on her forehead in those couple weeks. And I had noticed the original lump growing a little bit in those 2 weeks. But I thought I was crazy. I thought I was just imagining things. And I thought, no, they said it's benign and it's slow growing, and this couldn't be, you know, real. Like, I'm just imagining this, you know. But then when they came in and said, this is not what we thought it was originally, they were not the original ones that diagnosed it. It was a different radiologist. But I thought, like, that's kind of when she had had other symptoms leading up to that, but they were pretty mild. And just kind of typical for a 2-year-old. And, you know, they did get progressively worse. But at that point is when I kind of thought, oh my, I wonder if this lump has something to do with all those other symptoms. And I wonder what this is. I did not think it was cancer, certainly. I did not think it was cancer. But I didn't know what it was, and they didn't either. So I don't know.
They had the biopsy, and 2 days later, on February 23rd, the preliminary results showed that Maisie did have either lymphoma or leukemia. And then you had mentioned the symptoms that she had, which you kind of thought were attributed to perhaps cold and flu season in Utah at the time. She did have, you recall, some fatigue she had. She had some fevers. She had some bruising and maybe some abdominal pain, but it was difficult to put two and two together. So the thought was that she had something, but it was probably due to the environment and the weather and the time of the year more than anything else. And then you got the news that she had either lymphoma or leukemia, and she was probably in a very high risk category.
Yeah, she was. She was. Yeah.
And when you heard the diagnosis, knowing that you don't know how a cancer situation is going to turn out, but that any cancer situation is serious. And 4 months earlier, you had lost Crew. Did you have a support team in place, either at the hospital or friends and family, that helped you get through this news, and also your husband, Jimmer, this news, which was just so unfathomable? And what was that period like, hearing the news and trying to go on from there?
Oh my, it was just overwhelming. I remember that we were in the waiting room. It was outpatient, right? It was that outpatient surgery where everybody's waiting, and the surgeons kept coming in to meet with the families that were in there, and they would come in and take off their surgeon cap, you know, and say to their family that your son did great. He's back in the wait, you know, he's back in recovery. And we just watched them come in one by one. And then finally our neurosurgeon came in and said, I need to meet with you in this room. And that's never a good sign. And so that's when he delivered the news, and we just were shocked. Like, I remember turning to my husband and saying, you told me it wasn't cancer. Like, he had any control over it, obviously, but I think he was just trying to comfort me and, you know, keep me calm and, you know, reassure me that it was going to be okay. And anyway, we were just both in shock. And so from that point, it kind of becomes a blur, but we obviously just broke down and we were calling family and friends. I had two older boys at the time who were 8 and 5. And so obviously we needed help with them. And we had so much support from the hospital. I remember the nurse in the recovery area who cried with me. And I mean, just so many, the staff and doctors, nurses, everyone was so supportive there. And then at home, we had a whole nother set of people, just family, friends, neighbors, who just jumped in right away and were taking care of our boys and helping with, you know, meals and cleaning our house and, you know, emotional support. And it was amazing to see that. That part was just such a blessing and amazing to see.
I don't know how you and could have gotten through this sort of thing without that type of support. Thankfully,
absolutely,
you know, they were there for you. Now, Maisie spent the next 2.5 years, which lasted until July of 2019, in treatment. Can you talk about some of the treatment protocol that she went through? I know it included hundreds of hospital visits and a full brain radiation in early 2018, among other less than pleasant ordeals that she was forced to endure.
Sure. She was ultimately diagnosed with pre-B cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which, you know, is a pretty, it's pretty common in the pediatric cancer world. That I didn't know any of this before. I was totally, you know, cancer was pretty foreign to me. I had known, you know, like some people, but never, I hadn't known a pediatric cancer patient before this. And I didn't know that there were different types of leukemia. I didn't know there were different subtypes of leukemia, and some that were more common, less common, more treatable, less treatable. And so we, when they gave us that diagnosis, they said it's pretty treatable. There's a pretty high success rate, but we need to do more testing. And so those first few days in the hospital is just, they start you on chemo right away. And I think that first day they give you your first dose of chemo. They do a bone marrow biopsy. They do x-rays and scans and blood work and all the things to figure out what type of leukemia it is. So going back a little bit, they did confirm it was leukemia and the type and the subtype. And then from there, they did like a lumbar puncture, because I guess leukemia can hide in the central nervous system, in the brain and the spinal fluid. And unfortunately, she was positive for cancer in her central nervous system. And it seemed like they just kept coming in, giving us this negative news time after time. And they said, this is, I guess when you're first diagnosed, there's a series of 5 or 6 things that they look at to put you in a risk group. And the risk group you're in determines which protocol you go on. And so one of them's the age at the diagnosis. And mind you, this was, you know, 7 years ago, and things are constantly changing. So I don't know if it's changed a little bit. I know the protocols have changed a little bit since we've been on treatment. But anyway, one of them's the age. One of them's your white blood cell count. One of them is central nervous system involvement. And based on these factors and some others, they place you in a risk group. So I tell people with leukemia, you know, it originates in your bone marrow, which is all over your body, right? And so you can't have stages like with other types of cancer. You hear of like, oh, stage one, stage two, stage three. With leukemia, they just have risk groups. So based on these other factors, they have a very high risk group, a high risk group, and a standard risk group. And so obviously the higher risk you are, the risk meaning risk for relapse. And she was placed, once you have a CNS positive result, then you're automatically placed on the very high risk protocol, which means you just get more chemo and more lumbar punctures with chemo. And then she also had to have full brain radiation, which is pretty unique for the leukemia kids. Most of them don't have to have radiation. I know back in the, like years ago, they used to radiate their spine and their brain and things like that anyway, but things have changed. And so she did have to have full brain radiation, and she had all types of chemos. And before I was in the cancer world, I thought chemotherapy meant one medicine, you know? And I learned that there's just hundreds of types of chemotherapy drugs, and you know, and they keep coming up with new ones, and the research is amazing, and they keep coming up with new therapies, immunotherapies, and CAR T cell, and you know, different things like that. And thankfully, she hasn't had to have a bone marrow transplant, but that some kids have to have bone marrow transplants, and anyway, so all of that. You know, she was on oral meds at times. She had shots in her legs at times that were really painful. She had to have, you know, bone marrow biopsies, and she had a port placed in her chest, and, she was a trooper. She really handled all of it really, really well. And, I mean, inpatient, outpatient, you know, the cancer world is unpredictable, so you could never really predict how long appointments would be. And with her protocol, most of it was outpatient, but she had a few inpatient rounds where she had to be inpatient for treatment. And then there were also unexpected inpatient stays, which I know people have talked on here before, like the protocol for fevers with cancer kids is, if it's above, you know, 100.4, I think, or 101.0, they have to go in to the ER right away, or to the oncology clinic if it's open, you know, if it's during office hours. Anyway, so she had a lot of those, a lot of fevers. So a lot of unexpected stays were, and a couple times where it was really scary where she got septic, and you know, we're about 45 minutes from our children's hospital. And there was one or two times when I got stuck on the freeway and I was like, I don't know if we're going to make it to the hospital, you know? And I thought, if I call 911 right now, how are they going to get to me? You know? And I thought, thankfully I didn't have to, but I would look back in her car seat and she just looked gray and was so sick. And anyway, so thankfully there were only a couple of those times, but I mean, she went through a lot and handled it amazingly well.
Well, it's incredible. And I was reading about the cancer being in the central nervous system. I think 4%. I think that's yes. What I read of yeah. Patients have that. So that puts you into the very high risk category, which is, you know, just one other thing that you certainly did not need at right. that time. My goodness. Right. Now, there was a breath of fresh air, I would say, when you were able to take Maisie to Disneyland as she had graduated into her maintenance program. What was that like for you and your family? And was she feeling well enough to really enjoy herself?
So we went to Disneyland after that first year of treatment, which is considered the most intense and difficult because we're at the hospital, you know, several times a week on average. And then that second year, and a half is called maintenance, where we are only at the hospital once a month. So it's a big change from that previous year. And at the beginning of her maintenance, she had to have her radiation. And so we decided as a family, after she finishes radiation, we're going to take a big trip. It'll be something to look forward to. And we'll celebrate being in maintenance, number one, and finishing radiation, number two. And so we did go, and it was so much fun. We had a blast. I think especially for my boys, it was really fun. And, you know, they had kind of been just thrown around that first year. And, oh, I just felt terrible. And, you know, mom guilt was very high. But anyway, this was a very healing and fun trip for our family. Maybe I remember her being quite tired and she slept a lot of the time. And I guess it was radiation side effects. So they said, like, I can't remember how many weeks after she was finished that we went, but she slept a lot during the trip and was, I mean, obviously not at her best, but I think when she was awake, she did have fun and enjoyed it, you know? So we're thankful we got to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thankful you did. And then she came back to do her maintenance program, which seemed to be going well, thankfully, except in the last 6 months of treatment, Maisie developed a number of urinary tract infections, which turned into kidney infections. And you mentioned the word septic, which I think happened to her several times. How scary were those situations? And maybe when I say scary, maybe those included the car rides that you were sitting in traffic. Even though what she was going through with those were not directly related to the leukemia battle. And how were these infections eventually dealt with?
So... like you said, she started getting these UTIs and they would develop into kidney infections, which would then spread because of her immunocompromisation. Because she was immunocompromised, they would spread to her bloodstream, which is very scary to have an infection in your bloodstream. And we didn't know what was happening at first. They just thought because she was immunocompromised, she was getting these UTIs, which I guess is pretty common for that age. She was like four at the time. And let's see. Yeah, she was about four at the time and was getting these UTIs. And there were a couple times, I remember one time in particular where I called the oncologist on call because she was screaming in pain that her back hurt. And when I got on the phone with them, they said, you need to go to your local ER. Like, don't come up to Primary Children's because that sounds like a kidney infection. And they could hear her screaming in the background. And it was really, really scary. And so, you know, combined with all her other symptoms, she had a fever. She had pain while urinating and all the typical UTI symptoms, you know. And then in addition to that back pain, the doctor said, go to your local hospital. So they didn't even want us driving that 45 minutes. So we have a hospital about 5 minutes away, 10 minutes away from here. And so we went there and they immediately started her on antibiotics. And I don't remember if this might have been the second or third UTI kind of in a row. And so I remember at our next oncology appointment, our oncologist said, let's send you to urology because we need to figure out why this is happening. If it's, you know, why does this keep happening? And so we went to urology and they did more scans and more tests to ultimately diagnose her with what's called a duplicate collecting system or something like that, where she has two, you usually just have one ureter coming from each kidney, and she has two coming from one of her kidneys and one coming from the other. And because of that, I guess you're more prone to reflux.
And so she had very severe reflux in her bladder, which means that the urine, instead of going into the bladder, it would shoot up back into the ureters, back up into the kidneys. So instead of a healthy person with a UTI would be able to get rid of it, hers was shooting back up into her kidney. And then because of her immunocompromised status, that was spreading to her body. And that happened, like I said, 4 or 5 times. And it was really scary. I remember one time being in Salt Lake. We live about, you know, half an hour from Salt Lake City in a suburb. And we were up in Salt Lake, and Primary Children's was pretty close by. And I remember it hitting another time while we were out and about, and she was complaining of back pain. And by this point, I had learned what that meant. And immediately we headed to the hospital because I knew what that meant. Anyway, so it was extremely scary each time. There were a couple times that the doctor told us, like, she would have been dead within 24 hours. Like, these things spread so quickly. And especially when you don't have an immune system. She had a little bit of an immune system because it was that second year of treatment. Where they're not as immunocompromised, but still, I guess it was just really dangerous and scary. And so I'm really grateful that we figured out what was wrong. And then because of the timeline, it just happened to kind of line up with her end of treatment for cancer. And she was able, when they had her port removed on the last day of treatment, they also did the bladder surgery at the same time. So that was nice that she didn't have to have separate surgeries. And she had the reflux corrected. And they said it's a very successful surgery. And thankfully, she hasn't really had problems since then. So that bladder surgery was successful. And she'll have to be kind of mindful of that as she gets older and things like that. Like, she'll have to just be careful and things like that with her bladder and her kidneys, but thankfully it was relatively an easy fix. So
I'm certainly glad to hear that. And, you know, for what she went through, it's nice that she got some sort of a break at the right time with the bladder surgery and everything else. Thankfully that worked out. Now in July of 2019, Maisie was able to ring the bell, which signified that a treatment was over and the next phase of her life could begin. How amazing was that for you, for Maisie, for Jimmer and your children and everyone else involved?
Oh my goodness. It was such a happy day. I remember hearing, you know, throughout treatment, when you're in, you know, the oncology clinic or inpatient, you'd hear the bell being rung, you know, and you'd think that we are never going to get there. I remember thinking, 2.5 years is so long. We are never going to ring the bell. And here we were, you know, we made it to the end of treatment. And one thing, so we were thrilled and so grateful that, you know, she was well, you know, relatively speaking, and that we had made it to the end of treatment, because we certainly knew a lot of kids that didn't. And so we were just grateful. And one thing that I wasn't expecting at the end of treatment was the anxiousness post-treatment. So you think, okay, once we get to that bell ringing, you know, all will be well. Everything's going to be done and we won't have to deal with this ever again. And I have talked to other cancer moms who have felt similarly, to where there's kind of this feeling of anxiety post-treatment, where this safety net, it kind of sounds funny, but this chemo safety net, which is keeping the cancer away, is taken out from under you. And you're like, now what's keeping the cancer away, you know? And so there's kind of this fear, certainly overwhelming gratitude, but there's also this kind of this conflicting feeling of fear, like, what if it comes back? When is it going to come back? And all the initial symptoms that you see sometimes again post-treatment, like you'll see a bruise and you'll think, oh no, she has low platelets, you know, that means she's relapsing, you know, or one time she had a really swollen lymph node post-treatment and her pediatrician was like, we need to call oncology. This is in a weird place and this can't be good. And anyway, so any little thing you just kind of like blow out of proportion sometimes. And certainly, you know, unfortunately, we've learned that, you know, relapse does happen and long-term side effects do happen almost to all the kids. And so there is, I mean, that fear is valid, right? So I think the challenge for us moving forward was to, and this is certainly one thing that cancer has taught us, is to just focus on right now. And just to focus on, you know, today she's doing well and we are so grateful and we're just going to enjoy today, you know? And, you know, in 5 years or 10 years or who knows what, maybe she'll have a brain tumor from radiation or maybe she'll, you know, who knows what, you know, there's a list never ending of possible side effects and short term and long term and things like that. And so we've certainly just tried to, and obviously it's been a process, and we're still learning, right? But as time goes on, I think we're able to, or we're trying to just focus on right now and appreciate what we've gone through and humbled by, you know, the circumstance we're in and just grateful. I don't know any other word than to, you know, how to express how we feel and grateful. And I know, you know, we are really close with our cancer community and, you know, we see, unfortunately, lots of kids pass away and it's just heartbreaking. And so we just feel for them and continue to pray for them. And, I mean, we certainly know what it's like to lose a child. So we can empathize in that way. But sometimes you do have that survivor's guilt too, you know, where you feel like, why did my kid make it and theirs didn't, you know? But anyway, I'd say that mostly we're just trying to focus on right now and just how grateful we are and trying to find the beauty in every day and in every moment. And we're certainly not perfect at it, but we're working on it, you know?
You know, you summed up the situation so beautifully. I mean, the fact is, that's what happens. She gets out of treatment or he gets out of treatment. Everything's going to be great. And then and the problem with that is that life then enters the situation, and it's such a natural reaction. Anytime I'm sure that any parent looks and sees something a little bit amiss, it's here we go again.
Yes.
And you know the fact is if you don't know too much about pediatric cancer, which is okay if you've never been involved in and
right.
you don't wish anybody. Be involved in it, the natural thought is, well, 5 years, he or she is clear. We're all set. Nothing is further from the mm-hmm. truth, as right. you have found out. I'd like to ask you just a little bit about, you have six children.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you do it, but you've got six children. And the fact is, You mentioned the difficulty that you have with your two older boys. It's called the back burner syndrome, which is something that has to happen. I mean, when Jimmer isn't working, you have to concentrate on helping the one who needs it the most, which of course was Maisie. How are your children doing today after experiencing that situation now that Maisie's doing much better? How was it for them? And have they pretty much put this issue behind them? Or does it still linger in some way with any of your children?
So I would say with my older boys, short answer, yes and no. I would say mostly, you know, kids are so resilient. And at the same time, you know, they went through kind of back-to-back traumatic experiences. And my five-year-old at the time, it's really interesting because you think,
oh, they're too young to remember, or, you know, I wonder what they do remember. And it's interesting to see what they do remember, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And then obviously, you know, there's this grief process that we all go through. And it's interesting to see how that changes through the years, right? As they get older and develop, I feel like, in general, I feel like they're doing really, really well. Like they both, you know, do well in school. They have friends. They, you know, are playing sports. They're doing music. You know, they're doing really well. Every once in a while, something will come up, you know. Now that we're almost 5 years post-treatment, which is just crazy, we only go to the doctor annually, to her oncologist, which is amazing. And whenever I do have to take her to the doctor, my big boys are like, what's wrong with Maisie? What happened to Maisie? You know, and they kind of panic for a minute. And so I know that there's still obviously some wounds and healing that has to happen. And I feel like that, you know, is a lifelong process maybe, but I feel like overall they have been really great. They've been resilient. They've, you know, we're people of faith and we believe in God and we believe that He's ultimately who helped us through and has helped heal our hearts and our wounds and will continue to do so. And, you know, when those moments come up, it's, you know, I've thought about how to handle those moments when the fear comes up again. And I've thought, you know, I could be really bitter about this and angry that, you know, my first thought is to go to cancer. My kid's first thought is, I had, you know, whenever there's any medical issue in our family, you know, which thankfully most everybody's pretty healthy. But whenever I had a son that had a seizure a few months ago and, you know, things like that, whenever there's any medical scare, I guess, or incident, our tendency is kind of maybe to panic a little bit. And, I've thought about like how to kind of reframe this into a positive thing. And I'm not perfect at it, but to think, you know, it really does make you thankful for help and for healthy bodies and for the general well-being, you know, that we're blessed to have. And so in that sense, you know, I'm really grateful. I can't even believe I'm saying those words, but I really am grateful for our cancer experience. The people we've met and just the perspective change, it kind of makes you go through, you know, it kind of makes you focus on things that are more important in life, you know, and I'm just really grateful in that regard that we've had that experience. And so my kids have, you know, I'm trying to teach them that, you know. And I think they've taught me more than I could ever teach them. But yeah, I guess in general, they're just doing great. And when we have those moments come up, we try to refocus and reflect on how blessed we are. And, you know, even in trials or through trials, we still can see the hand of God and we, you know, feel like we feel extremely blessed. Yeah.
Great attitude is so important in this fight, and you certainly have developed or have one that is very beneficial, not just for you, but for your family as well. Now, Maisie is now in a survivorship clinic or survivorship program, which began in February of this year at Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City. As you mentioned, long-term effects can and generally do happen to almost all pediatric cancer patients. 95% of them have some sort of a long term issue. And most of these issues occur by the time the patient's 45 years old. So I'm sure that you have heard all of the facts, the figures about that. What type of program have they put her on? I know that she's had some issues with her teeth, and I believe she also had a foot issue. Have they mentioned anything else specifically that they'd like to work on with her, or what she should perhaps look for, or you should look for in the next few years or so?
Yeah, so this year we did graduate to the survivorship clinic at Primary Children's, which I guess is a relatively new clinic. And it's, I think it's great because that means that there's more survivors, right? And they've found this need for, I mean, possibly a subspecialty in oncology, right? To focus on late side effects, you know? And so I think it's been in place there for a couple years now, but we just started going this year. And they are amazing. It's run by a couple, you know, two or three oncologists. And they are very thorough. We went in February, and they gave us a whole packet of every single chemotherapy drug she took and had administered, and then what systems of the body it affects and how, possible long-term effects, and what to look for, and things like that. And I remember getting something similar to that at the beginning of treatment, and being so overwhelmed because I thought, you know, what if, you know, look at all these, there's pages of side effects, right? Possible side effects. And I remember our oncologist saying, you know, maybe for now, just focus on the top line of that packet, which says kills cancer cells, you know? And that for me was a change in my mindset. And I'm really grateful she pointed that out because it is so easy to, you know, just worry about, oh no, like possible, you know, heart failure when they're 40, and oh no, this one causes infertility, and you know, radiation causes these issues with their thyroid, and this will cause, you know, learning disabilities and whatever, you know, I mean, it's just every single thing under the sun, you know, it can affect every single thing, part of their body, and steroids in the bones, it makes their bones weaker and whatever, you know, there's so many things. And so I'm really grateful that my doctor, that our doctor said that to me at the beginning, because it made me try to focus on the positive things. I've tried to have a similar mindset when looking at the, you know, pages of possible side effects she could have. You know, I know some kids have more long-term side effects. I know that she has some, you know, in her future, there could possibly be more side effects. I try not to worry about it right now. I try to just be aware, like, okay, she could have heart failure when she's 40. So right now she's just having regular echoes, to just keep up on that. You know what I mean? And we're just trying to, I don't know if I should say stay ahead, but just kind of be aware and not let that fear take over the joy that we feel, you know? I could be, and don't get me wrong, I am angry some days, and I feel bitterness some days. And, but I feel like we've had many years to heal and work through some of these feelings. And so when I look at all the possible side effects, I just feel like gratitude for her resilience. And sure, she had some side effects. They're not life-threatening, you know? And it honestly, it's like, it's almost like I don't know the word to use, but just it just kind of proves how strong she is and what a warrior she is. That's kind of how, it's like a battle wound. That's kind of how I view it. You know, like you have these teeth without any enamel. Look at that. You survived cancer. You know, look at that. You are so strong. You know, we can deal with that. I know a good dentist, your dad, he can help with that, you know, but, that's how I try to view it now is, you know, there's all these possible side effects and who knows, she may not be able to bear children, which would be so devastating and so hard, but she's 9. So I'm not going to worry about it right now. And when she gets to childbearing age, then we'll deal with that, you know? And, anyway, that's just kind of how I've chosen to view it, you know, and view it more like a positive thing than negative.
I think your attitude is really spot on. That's the way you have to do it. You try to be aware of things that could happen, and a million things could happen to her and everybody else. When you think about it, I mean, you just don't know what the future is going to hold, but you're aware of everything. And if something seems amiss at some point, you and her, you know, she's going to be, this may happen in her 20s and 30s, and she's going to have to make these decisions, you know, on her own. But the more awareness you have now, the better off it'll be. Now, you mentioned she's 9 years old. How is Maisie doing academically, socially, athletically? I know she plays soccer. And despite everything that she's been through, is she pretty much living the life of a normal, healthy 9-year-old girl?
She is. If you saw her, you know, you would think, you would have no clue that any of this happened, you know, and she just has taken off and flown. She's doing great academically. They told us from her radiation, she would have learning disabilities, and they run in my family anyways. So it's like, if she did, which thankfully she hasn't had any so far that we know of. They do like the psychology, the psych eval. What are those tests called? I can't remember, but anyway, they kind of do those evals to make sure academically they're okay. And she's had one and did really well, and we're just kind of keeping that as a baseline. And then if she has issues in school, then we'll go back to the psychologist and have her reevaluate it anyway. But she's doing great in school. She has so many friends. She's a social butterfly. She's my most social child that I have. And every day, can I go play with my friends? Can I go play with my friends? And thankfully we have an awesome neighborhood with tons of friends, and she goes out and plays with her friends every day, and she plays soccer and loves soccer so much. She does have some foot pain, and it could be from cancer. It could be from normal childhood ailments. We don't really know, but it doesn't stop her from playing and doing what she loves. And she's really just doing amazing, which we're so grateful for.
You mentioned before that, and you mentioned a couple of times now, of the relationships that you have built with fellow cancer parents and how important they have become. Have you also had the reverse situation where once, of course, you had already lost a child, but then Maisie gets diagnosed? Did you have any friends who were no longer friends because they couldn't deal with what you were going through? Because that, unfortunately, can be a part of a pediatric cancer experience.
I wouldn't say friends that weren't friends. I would just say, and I've been guilty of this myself. Some people just don't know how to handle it. Some people don't want to be faced with sadness, and I don't want to either. You know, like, it's a hard thing to watch somebody suffer, and not be able to do anything about it. And so I wouldn't say I've lost friends. I would say different people have kind of stepped up maybe and helped us in different ways. And then others have been more quiet of a support, you know, which I'm okay with, because I feel like
I think about myself before all of this happened, and I think, okay, if someone were to come up and say, oh, my daughter has cancer, you know, it's been really hard. I think I wouldn't have known what to do. I would be probably awkward, and I maybe would have shied away a little bit and not known how to help, not known what to say, afraid of saying something wrong, right? And so I don't fault people for, you know, either stepping away for a minute or, you know, because it's a lot to process when you're going through it. And I know it's a lot to process, you know, as a friend to watch somebody suffer. And so I don't fault people for, you know, maybe, you know, we've had some interesting comments made, as you can imagine, and you can view them as insensitive, or I just chose to view them as they just don't really understand, you know? And so I try not, I have to say in the moment, there were times that I've been upset or offended or whatever, but I've tried to, over the years, realize that people just don't know, you know? But people do know pain. Like, everybody knows pain. Everyone knows what it feels like to struggle and go through trials and hurt, you know? And everybody deals with those feelings in different ways. So I would say I haven't lost friends. If anything, I just maybe felt more compassion for the people who don't know what to say, because I was that person and sometimes still am, right? When someone goes through something you don't know, you've never been there or something, you just kind of are like, I don't know what to say to them. I don't want to say the wrong thing, you know? So I don't know.
Perfectly understandable, of course. What has Maisie taught you? I know that we've talked about resilience, not only taught you, but taught others, especially your other children, and Jimmer.
Oh my goodness. So much. She has just been, I mean, just solid. Even at 2.5, you know, she just was mature and she just came that way, you know, like she came strong. She came ready to fight, you know. She has taught us how to be resilient, you know, physically, emotionally, in every way. She's taught us how to put our trust in God. She's taught us how to just enjoy the moment, being present. You know, these all seem like cliche things, but she's really taught us those things.
Well, I think what happens in most pediatric cancer cases that the patient is the one that does the teaching.
Yes.
And the parents are the ones that do the learning, because yes. You know, you're picturing your daughter or son, you know, in this situation, which no one would want. And all of a sudden they're teaching you, you have to do this and you have to act this way. And it's a tremendous learning experience. And I think, you know, these kids, whether it's inbred or just, you know, being taught as they grow older, they are amazing at the mm-hmm. way they can handle it. And they can handle it much better emotionally than we could.
Absolutely.
I guarantee you that.
Absolutely. 100%. Yes.
Where can people get in touch with you? Your story is extremely compelling. You've been through more than anyone could ever deserve to be through on a number of occasions. And so it would be a way, whether it's email or whatever, to learn a little more about you and perhaps get in touch with you.
Yeah, email's a great way. Do you want me to tell you my
yep.
email, or do you just, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
My email's april.standring@gmail.com. And so April, like the month, APRIL dot stand ring, like you stand at a door and ring the doorbell, and then @gmail.com. So I'm happy to answer any questions or, you know, talk to parents or whatever. I would love to hear from anybody.
Well, as we come to the end of this podcast, you know, thankfully, things are in the best possible position considering what had happened, so many years ago, first of all, to Crew and then to Maisie, and the way that you've been able to handle this and your family's been able to handle this is truly inspiring. And I'm just happy to hear that things are going so well for Maisie. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come on my podcast and to wish her and everybody else in your family nothing but good health and happiness in the future.
Thank you so much.
And you have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
I think that we can all agree that losing a child at 13 days old, especially knowing that the end was inevitable, has to be as bad of an outcome as there possibly is. Thankfully, April's daughter Maisie, who was diagnosed with leukemia just 4 months later, has beaten back her form of pediatric cancer and has now been able to live the life that she and the Standring family richly deserve. This is Mark Levine, and please tune in on Monday when I will speak with Ryan Swallow, who will talk about the odyssey of his son Henry, who was diagnosed with bone marrow failure when he was 6 weeks old in February of 2020, and is now living a healthy life.